Random House Audio presents You Is for Undertow by Sue Grafton. This is Judy Kay. Chapter 1. Wednesday afternoon, April 6th, 1988. What fascinates me about life is that now and then the past rises up and declares itself. Afterward, the sequence of events seems inevitable, but only because cause and effect have been aligned in advance. It's like a pattern of dominoes arranged upright on a tabletop. With the flick of your finger, the first tile topples into the second, which in turn tips into the third, setting in motion a tumbling that goes on and on, each tile knocking over its neighbor until all of them fall down. Sometimes the impetus is pure chance, though I discount the notion of accidents. Fate stitches together elements that seem unrelated on the surface. It's only when the truth emerges you see how the bones are joined and everything connects. Here's the odd part. In my 10 years as a private eye, this was the first case I ever managed to resolve without crossing paths with the bad guys. Except at the end, of course. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private detective, female, age 37, with my 38th birthday coming up in a month. Having been married and divorced twice, I'm now happily single and expect to remain so for life. I have no children thus far, and I don't anticipate bearing any. Not only are my eggs getting old, but my biological clock wound down a long time ago. I suppose there's always room for one of life's little surprises, but that's not the way to bet. I work solo out of a rented bungalow in Santa Teresa, California, a town of roughly 85,000 souls, who generate sufficient crime to occupy the Santa Teresa Police Department, the County Sheriff's Department, the California Highway Patrol, and the 25 or so local private investigators like me. Movies and television shows would have you believe a PI's job is dangerous, but nothing could be farther from the truth. Except, of course, on the rare occasions when someone tries to kill me. Then I'm ever so happy my health insurance premiums are paid up. Threat of death aside, the job is largely research, requiring intuition, tenacity, and ingenuity. Most of my clients reach me by referral, and their business ranges from background checks to process serving, with countless other matters in between. My office is off the beaten path, and I seldom have a client appear unannounced. So when I heard a tapping at the door to my outer office, I got up and peered around the corner to see who it was. Through the glass, I saw a young man pointing at the knob. I'd apparently turned the deadbolt to the locked position when I'd come back from lunch. I let him in, saying, "Sorry about that. I must have locked up after myself without being aware of it." "You're Ms. Milhone?" "Yes." "Michael Sutton," he said, extending his hand. "Do you have time to talk?" We shook hands. "Sure. Can I offer you a cup of coffee?" "No, thanks. I'm fine." I ushered him into my office while I registered his appearance in a series of quick takes. Slim, lank brown hair with a sheen to it, worn long on top and cut short over his ears. Solemn brown eyes, complexion as clear as a baby's. There was a prep school air about him, deck shoes without socks, sharply creased chinos, and a short-sleeve white dress shirt he wore with a tie. He had the body of a boy, narrow shoulders, narrow hips, and long, smooth arms. He looked young enough to be carded if he tried to buy booze. I couldn't imagine what sort of problem he'd have that would require my services. I returned to my swivel chair, and he settled into the chair on the other side of the desk. I glanced at my calendar, wondering if I'd set up an appointment and promptly forgotten it. He noticed the visual reference and said, "Detective Phillips at the police department gave me your name and address. I should have called first, but your office was close by. I hope this isn't an inconvenience." "Not at all," I said. "My first name's Kinsey, which you're welcome to use. You prefer Michael or Mike?" "Most people call me Sutton." In my kindergarten class, there were two other Michaels, so the teacher used our last names to distinguish us. Borman, Sutton, and Trotwine, like a law firm. We're still friends. Where was this? Klimp, I said. Ah, I should have guessed as much. Klimping Academy is the private school in Horton Ravine, K through 12. Tuition starts at 12 grand for the little tykes, and rises incrementally through the upper grades. I don't know where it tops out, but you could probably pick up a respectable college education for the same price. All the students enrolled there referred to it as Klimp, as though the proper appellation was just like Sue beside the point. Watching him, I wondered if my blue-collar roots were as obvious to him as his upper-class status was to me. We exchanged pleasantries while I waited for him to unload. The advantage of a prearranged appointment is that I begin the first meeting with at least some idea of what a prospective client has in mind. People skittish about revealing their personal problems to a stranger often find it easier to do by phone. With this kid, I figured we'd have to dance around some before he got down to his business, whatever it was. He asked how long I'd been a private investigator. This is a question I'm sometimes asked at cocktail parties, on the rare occasion when I'm invited to one. It's the sort of blah, blah, blah conversational gambit I don't much care for. I gave him a rundown of my employment history. I skipped over the two lackluster semesters at the local junior college and started with my graduation from the police academy. I then covered the 2 years I'd worked for the Santa Teresa PD before I realized how ill-suited I was to a life in uniform. I proceeded with a brief account of my subsequent apprenticeship with a local agency run by Ben Bird and Morley Shine, two private investigators who'd trained me in preparation for licensing. I'd had my ups and downs over the years, but I spared him the details since he'd only inquired as a stalling technique. What about you? Are you a California native? Yes, ma'am. I grew up in Horton Ravine. My family lived on Via Inez until I went off to college. I lived a couple of other places, but now I'm back. You still have family here? His hesitation was one of those nearly imperceptible blips that indicates internal editing. My parents are gone. I have two older brothers, both married, with two kids each, and an older sister who's divorced. We're not on good terms. We haven't been for years. I let that pass without comment, being better acquainted with family estrangement than I cared to admit. How do you know Cheney Phillips? I don't. I went into the police department, asking to speak to a detective, and he happened to be free. When I told him my situation, he said, you might be able to help. Well, let's hope so, I said. Cheney's a good guy. I've known him for years. I shut my mouth then and let a silence descend. A stratagem with remarkable powers to make the other guy talk. Sutton touched the knot in his tie. I know you're busy, so I'll get to the point. I hope you'll bear with me. The story might sound weird. Weird stories are the best kind. So, fire away, I said. He looked to the floor as he spoke, making eye contact now and then to see if I was following. I don't know if you saw this, but a couple of weeks ago there was an article in the newspaper about famous kidnappings. Marion Parker, the 12-year-old girl who was abducted in 1927, the Lindbergh baby in 32, another kid named Eaton Potts. Ordinarily, I don't read things like that, but what caught my attention was the case here in town. You're talking about Mary Claire Fitzhugh, 1967. You remember her? Sure. I'd just graduated from high school. Little 4-year-old girl taken from her parents' home in Horton Ravine. The Fitzhughes agreed to pay the ransom, but the money was never picked up, and the child was never seen again. Exactly. The thing is, when I saw the name Mary Claire Fitzhugh, I had this flash, something I hadn't thought about for years. He clasped his hands together and squeezed them between his knees. When I was a little kid, I was playing in the woods, and I came across these two guys digging a hole. I remember seeing a bundle on the ground a few feet away. At the time, I didn't understand what I was looking at. But now I believe it was Mary Claire's body, and they were burying her. I said, "You actually saw the child?" He shook his head. "She was wrapped in a blanket, so I couldn't see her face or anything else." I studied him with interest. "What makes you think it was Mary Claire? That's a big leap." "Because I went back and checked the old newspaper accounts, and the dates line up."
"What dates?"
"Oh, sorry, I should have mentioned this before. She was kidnapped on July 19th, which was a Wednesday. I saw the guys on Friday, July 21st, 1967. My birthday, the year I turned 6. That's how I made the association. I think she was already dead by then, and they were getting rid of the body."
"And this was where?"
"Horton Ravine. I don't know the exact location. My mother had errands to run that day, so she dropped me off at some kid's house. I don't remember his name. I guess his mom had agreed to look after me while she was gone. Turns out the other kid woke up with a fever and sore throat. Chickenpox was going around, and his mom didn't want me exposed in case that's what it was. So she made him stay in his room while I hung around downstairs. I got bored and asked if I could go outside. She said I could as long as I didn't leave the property. I remember finding this tree with branches that hung down to make a little room. So I played there for a while, pretending I was a bandit in a cool hideout. I heard voices, and when I peeped through the leaves, I saw the two guys walk by with shovels and stuff, and I followed them."
"What time of day?"
"Must have been late morning, because after I came in again, the kid's mother fed me lunch. A plain lettuce and tomato sandwich, no bacon, and it was made with Miracle Whip. Our family didn't eat Miracle Whip. My mother wouldn't have it in the house. She said it was disgusting compared to real homemade mayonnaise."
"Your mother made mayonnaise?"
"The cook did."
"Ah."
"Anyway, Mom always said it was rude to complain, so I ate what I could and left the rest on my plate. The kid's mom hadn't even cut the crusts off the bread."
"There's a shock," I said.
"I'm impressed your memory's so clear." "Not clear enough, or I wouldn't be here. I'm pretty sure the two guys I saw were the ones who abducted Mary Claire, but I have no idea where I was. I know I'd never been to the house before, and I never went there again. Any chance one of your siblings would remember who the kid was?"
"I guess it's possible.
Unfortunately, we don't get along. We haven't spoken in years."
"So you said."
"Sorry. I don't mean to repeat myself. The point is, I can't call them up out of a clear blue sky. Even if I did, I doubt they'd talk to me."
"But I could ask, couldn't I?
That would be the obvious first move if you're serious about this." He shook his head. "I don't want them involved, especially my sister Dee. She's difficult. You don't want to mess with her."
"All right. We'll scratch that for now.
Maybe the kid's mother was being paid to babysit." "That wasn't my impression. More like she was doing Mom a favor."
"What about your classmates? Maybe she left you with one of the other moms, like a play date."
Sutton blinked twice. "That's a possibility I hadn't thought of. I've kept in touch with the other two Michaels, Borman and Trotwine, but that's the extent of it. I didn't like anybody else in my kindergarten class, and they didn't like me."
"It doesn't matter if you like them or not. We're trying to identify the boy."
"I don't remember anyone else." "It should be easy enough to come up with a list. You must have had class photos. You could go back to the school library and check the 67 yearbook." "I don't want to go back to Klimp. I hate the idea."
"It's just a suggestion.
So far, we're brainstorming," I said. "Tell me about the two guys. How old would you say?" "I'm not sure. Older than my brothers, who were 10 and 12 at the time, but not as old as my dad."
"Did they see you?"
"Not then. I decided to spy on them, but where they ended up was too far away, and I couldn't see what they were doing. I sneaked up on them, crawling through the bushes and crouching behind a big oak.
It was hot, and they were sweating, so they'd taken off their shirts. I guess I wasn't as quiet as I thought, because one of them spotted me, and they both jumped. They stopped what they were doing and asked what I wanted.
You actually talked to them?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. We had this whole conversation. I thought they were pirates, and I was all excited about meeting them.
Pirates?
My mother was reading me Peter Pan at bedtime, and I loved the illustrations. The pirates wore bandanas tied around their heads, which is what the two guys had done.
Beards, earrings, eye patches.
That netted me a smile, but not much of one. He shook his head. It was the bandanas that reminded me of pirates. I told them I knew that because of Peter Pan.
What did you talk about?
First, I asked them if they were pirates for real, and they told me they were. The one guy talked more than the other, and when I asked what they were doing, he said they were digging for buried treasure.
As Sutton spoke, I could see him regressing to the little boy he'd been, earnest and easily impressed. He leaned forward in his chair.
I asked if the treasure was gold doubloons, but they said they didn't know because they hadn't found it yet. I asked to see the treasure map, and they said they couldn't show me because they were sworn to secrecy. I'd seen the bundle on the ground over by this tree, and when I asked about it, the first guy said it was a bedroll in case they got tired. I offered to help dig, but he told me the job was only for grown-ups and little kids weren't allowed. And then the other one spoke up and asked where I lived. I told them I lived in a white house, but not on this street, that I was visiting. The first guy asked what my name was. I told him, and the other one spoke up again and said he thought he heard someone calling me, so I better go. Which is what I did. The whole exchange couldn't have taken more than 3 minutes.
I don't suppose either of them mentioned their names.
No, I probably should have asked, but it didn't occur to me.
Your recall impresses me.
Much of my life at that age is a total blank. I hadn't thought about the incident for years, but once the memory was triggered, I was right there again. Just like, boom.
I reran the story in my mind, trying to digest the whole of it.
Tell me again why you think there's a connection to Mary Claire.
That still seems like a stretch.
I don't know what else to say. Intuition, I guess.
What about the kidnapping? How did that go down?
I remember the broad strokes, but not the particulars. The whole thing was horrible. Those poor people. The ransom note said not to contact the police or the FBI, but Mr. Fitzhugh did it anyway. He thought it was the only way to save her, but he was wrong.
The first contact was the note?
Sutton nodded. Later, they phoned and said he had 1 day to get the money together, or else. Mr. Fitzhugh had already called the police, and they were the ones who contacted the FBI. The special agent in charge convinced him they'd have a better chance of nabbing the guys if he and his wife appeared to cooperate. So they advised him to do as he was told.
$25,000, wasn't it?
Somehow the number sticks in my head.
Exactly.
The kidnappers wanted it in small bills, packed in a gym bag. They called again and told him where he was supposed to leave the money. He stalled. They must have thought there was a trap on the line because they cut the call short. So he dropped off the ransom money, and the kidnappers didn't show.
Right.
After a day passed, it was clear the FBI had bungled it. They still thought they had a chance, but Mr. Fitzhugh said to hell with them and took matters into his own hands. He notified the newspapers and the radio and TV stations. After the story broke, Mary Claire was all anybody talked about. My parents and everyone else.
What day was it by then?
Sunday. Like I said before, she was kidnapped on Wednesday, and I saw them on Friday. The paper didn't carry the story until Sunday.
Why didn't you speak up?
I did. I'd already done that. When my mother came to get me, I told her about the pirates. I felt guilty. Like I'd done something wrong.
How so?
I don't know how to pin it down. I believed what they said about digging for treasure. When you're six, things like that make perfect sense. But on some level, I was anxious and I wanted reassurance. Instead, Mom got mad. She said I wasn't supposed to talk to strangers, and she made me promise I'd never do it again. When we got home, she sent me straight to my room. On Sunday, we heard the news about Mary Claire. And your mother didn't see the relevance? I guess not. She never mentioned it, and I was too scared to bring it up again. She'd already punished me once. I kept my mouth shut so she wouldn't punish me again. But it worried you. For a while, sure. After that, I put the incident out of my mind. Then I saw Mary Claire's name, and it all came back.
Did you ever see either guy again?
I don't think so. Maybe one of them. I'm not sure.
And where would that have been?
I don't remember. I might have made a mistake.
I picked up a pencil and made a mark on the yellow pad lying on my desk.
When you explained this to Cheney, what was his response?
His shoulder went up in a half shrug.
He said he'd check the old case notes,
but he couldn't do much more because the information I'd given him was too vague.
That's when he mentioned you.
Sounds like he was passing the buck.
Actually, what he said was you were like a little terrier when it came to flushing out rats.
Sucking up, I said. Mentally, I was rolling my eyes because Cheney wasn't far off the mark. I liked picking at problems, and this was a doozy.
What about the house itself? Think you'd recognize it if you saw it again?
I doubt it. Right after I read the article, I drove around the old neighborhood, and even the areas I knew well had changed. Trees were gone, shrubs were overgrown, new houses had gone up. Of course, I didn't cover the whole of Horton Ravine, but I'm not sure it would have made any difference since I don't have a clear image. I think I'd recognize the place in the woods. The house is a blur.
So 21 years later, you're clueless and hoping I can figure out where you were.
Yes, ma'am.
You want me to find an unmarked grave, basically a hole.
Can you do it?
I don't know. I've never tried before.
I studied him, chasing the idea around to see where it might go.
It's an interesting proposition. I'll give you that.
I rocked in my swivel chair, listening to the squeak, while I sifted through the story, wondering what I'd missed. There was something more going on, but I couldn't imagine what.
Finally, I said, "What's your stake in the situation? I know it bothers you, but why to this extent?"
"I don't know. I mean, the article talked about how the kidnapping ruined Mrs. Fitzhugh's life. She and her husband divorced, and he ended up leaving town. She still has no idea what happened to her little girl. She doesn't even know for sure she's dead. If I can help, it seems like the right thing to do."
"It's going to cost you," I said.
"I figured as much.
What sort of work do you do?"
"Nothing right now. I lost my job, so I'm on unemployment."
"What was the job?"
"I sold advertising for KSPL.
KSPL was the local AM station I sometimes tuned in on my car radio when I was tooling around town.
"How long were you there?"
"About a year, maybe a little less."
"What's it mean when you say you lost your job? Were you laid off, downsized, fired, what?"
He hesitated.
"The last one."
"Fired," he nodded.
I waited, and when it was clear he had no intention of continuing, I gave him a nudge.
Sutton, I'd consider it a courtesy if you'd be a bit more forthcoming. Would you care to fill me in?"
He rubbed his palms on his pants. "I said I had a BA from Stanford, but it wasn't really true. I was enrolled and attended classes for a couple of years, but I didn't graduate."
"So you lied on the application?"
"Look, I know I made a mistake."
"That would cover it," I said.
"But I can't do anything about it now. What's done is done, and I just have to move on."
I'd heard a host of criminals make the same remark, like, boosting cars, robbing banks, and killing folks could be brushed aside, a minor stumble on the path of life. Have you given any thought to how you're going to pay me out of your unemployment benefits? We're talking about $500 a day plus expenses, assuming I agree to help, which I haven't. I have some money set aside. I thought I'd write a check for one day's work and we'd see how it goes from there. A check? A flush tinted his cheeks. I guess that's not such a hot idea. You got that right. What's plan B? If you're going to be here for a while, I could make a quick run to the bank and bring you cash. I considered the notion. The prime item on my Thursday to-do list was to make a bank deposit and pay bills. I had two reports to write and a few calls to make, but I could shift those to Friday. The job itself might end in folly, but at least when he mentioned the right thing to do, he didn't turn around and ask me to work for free. I wasn't convinced he was right about what he'd seen, but Cheney must have considered the story credible or he wouldn't have sent him over to me. Okay. One day, but that's it. And only if you pay me cash in advance. I'll be here until 5 o'clock. That should give you plenty of time. Great. That's great. I don't know how great it is, but it's the best I can do. When you get back, if I happen to be out, you can stick the money through the mail slot. In the meantime, give me a contact number so I'll know how to reach you. I handed him my yellow pad and watched while he scribbled down his address and telephone number. In return, I handed him my business card with my office number and address. He said, "I really appreciate this. I don't know what I'd have done if you hadn't agreed. I'll probably regret it. But what the hell? It's only one day," I said. If I'd been listening closely, I'd have caught the sound of the gods having a great big old tee-hee at my expense. I said, "You're sure you don't want to make the trip up to Klimp? It would save you a few bucks." "I don't want to. They probably wouldn't talk to me in any event." "I see." I studied him. "You want to tell me what's going on here? You can't talk to your siblings, and now you can't talk to your prep school pals?" "I already told you I didn't have pals. It has more to do with the administration." "How come?" "There were some difficulties. I had a problem."
"Like what? You were expelled?"
I love stories about flunking and expulsions. With my history of screw-ups, those are like fairy tales. "It's not something I want to get into. It has nothing to do with this." A stubborn note had crept into his voice. "You go up there. They'll let you see your books as easily as me."
"I doubt it.
Educational institutions hate handing over information about their students, especially with the words private investigator thrown into the mix. Don't tell them you're a PI. Think of something else." "I didn't even attend Klimping Academy, so why would I want to see a yearbook? It makes no sense." He shook his head. "I won't do it. I have my reasons."
"Which you're not about to share."
"Right."
"Okay, fine. It's no skin off my nose.
If that's how you want to spend your $500, I can live with it." I love driving through Horton Ravine. I got up, and as we shook hands again, I realized what was bothering me. "One more question."
"What's that?"
"The article came out 2 weeks ago. Why'd you wait so long before you went to the police?" He hesitated. "I was nervous. All I have is a hunch. I didn't want the police to write me off as a crank."
"Nah, that's not all of it. What else?"
He was silent for a moment, color rising in his cheeks again. "What if the guys find out I remembered them? I might have been the only witness, and I told them my name. If they're the ones who killed Mary Claire, why wouldn't they kill me?"
Chapter 2. While Sutton and I were chatting, the mail had been delivered. Walking him to the door, I paused to collect the scattering of envelopes the postman had pushed through the slot. Once he'd gone off to the bank, I moved into my office, sorting and separating the stack as I sat down at my desk. Junk, bill, another bill, junk, junk, bill. I came to a square vellum envelope with my name and address written in calligraphy.
Ms. Kinsey Milhone, with lots of downstrokes and flourishes. Very la-di-da. The postmark was Lompoc, California, and the return address was printed in the center of the back flap. Even without the sender's name and evidence, I knew it was a Kinsey family member, one of numerous kin whose existence I'd first learned about 4 years before. Until that strange turn of events, I'd prided myself on my loner status. There was a benefit to my being an orphan in the world, explaining as it did, at least to my way of thinking, my difficulties in forming close bonds with others of my species. Looking at the envelope, I could guess what was coming up. A christening, a wedding, or a cocktail party. Some formal affair heralded by expensive embossing on heavy cardstock. Whatever the occasion, I was being informed of or invited to an event I didn't give a rat's ass about. At times, I'm a sentimental little thing. But this wasn't one. I tossed the envelope on my desk, then thought better of it and threw it in the wastebasket, which was already brimming with trash. I picked up the phone and punched in the number for Cheney Phillips at the STPD. When he picked up, I said, "Guess who?" "Hey, Kinsey, what's up?" "I just had a chat with Michael Sutton, and I thought I better touch base with you before I did anything else. What's the deal with him?" "Beats me. That story sounded just screwy enough to be true. What was your impression?" "I'm not sure. I'm willing to believe he saw two guys digging a hole. What I'm skeptical about is the relevance to Mary Claire Fitzhugh. He says the dates line up because he went back and checked his recollections against the articles in the paper. But that doesn't prove anything. Even if the two events happened at the same time, that doesn't mean they're related."
"Agreed. But his recollections were so specific, he pretty much talked me into it."
"Me too. At least in part," I said. "Did you have a chance to look at the old files?"
"Can't be done. I talked to the chief and he says the case notes are sealed. Once the FBI stepped in, they put everything under lock and key."
"Even after all this time? It's been 20 years.
21, to be precise. And the answer is definitely. You know how it goes. The case is federal and the file's still active. If the details are leaked, then any clown off his meds can walk into the department and claim responsibility."
I caught a familiar racket out in the street. "Hang on a sec." I put my hand over the mouthpiece and listened, picking up the hydraulic grinding wheeze and hiss of a garbage truck approaching from down the block. Shit. Garbage day. The week before, I'd forgotten to take out my trash, and my waste baskets were maxed out. "I gotta go. I'll call you later."
"Vaya con Dios."
I hung up in haste and headed down the hall to the kitchenette where I grabbed a plastic bag from a carton under the sink. I did a quick round of the waste baskets, kitchen, bathroom, and office, shaking trash into the plastic bag until it sagged from the weight. I scurried out the back door, tossed the bag in my trash bin, and rolled it down the walkway on one side of the bungalow. By the time I reached the street, the garbage truck was idling at the curb, and I just managed to catch the guy before he hopped back on. He paused long enough to add my contribution to the day's haul. As the truck pulled away, I blew him a kiss and was rewarded with a wave. I returned to my desk, congratulating myself on a job well done. Nothing makes a room look messier than a wastebasket full of trash. As I settled in my swivel chair, I glanced down and spotted the vellum envelope, which had apparently missed the plastic bag and now lay on the floor. I leaned over, picked it up, and stared at it. What was going on? Instead of happily winging its way to the county dump, the damn thing was back. I'm not superstitious by nature, but the envelope, coupled with Michael Sutton's reference to his family estrangement, had set an old train of thought in motion. I knew how treacherous and frail family bonds could be. My mother had been the eldest of five daughters born to my grandparents, Burton Kinsey and Cornelia Straith LeGrand, known since as Grand. My parents had been jettisoned from the bosom of the family when my mother met my father and eloped with him 4 months later. She was 18 at the time and came from money, albeit of the small-town sort. My father, Randy Milhone, was 33 years old and a mail carrier. In retrospect, it's difficult to say which was worse in Grand's eyes, his advanced age or his occupation. Apparently, she viewed civil servants right up there with career criminals as undesirable mates for her precious firstborn girl. Rita Cynthia Kinsey first clapped eyes on my father at her coming-out party, where my father was filling in as a waiter for a friend who owned the catering company. Their marriage created a rift in the family that had never healed. My Aunt Jin was the only one of her four sisters who sided with her, and she ended up raising me after my parents were killed in a car wreck when I was five. You'd think I'd have been pleased to discover the existence of close kin. Instead, I was pissed off, convinced they'd known about me for years and hadn't cared enough to seek me out. I was 34 when the first family overtures were made, and I counted their 29 years' silence as evidence of crass indifference, for which I blamed Grand. I really didn't have a quarrel with my aunts and cousins. I tossed them into the pit with Grand because it was simpler that way. I'll admit it wasn't fair, but I took a certain righteous satisfaction in my wholesale condemnation. For the past 2 or 3 years, I'd made a half-hearted attempt to modify my attitude, but it hadn't really worked. I'm a Taurus. I'm stubborn by nature, and I had my heels dug in. I shoved the invitation in my shoulder bag. I'd deal with it later. Sutton returned after 20 minutes with 5 crisp $100 bills, for which I wrote him a receipt. Once he was gone again, I locked the cash in my office safe. Since I'd be devoting Thursday to Sutton's business, I sat down and did a rough draft of one of the client reports on my to-do list, figuring I might as well get one chore out of the way. By the time I'd finished, it was close to 4, and I decided to shut down for the day. One reason I'm self-employed is so I can do as I please without consulting anyone else. I rescued my car from the semi-legal parking spot I'd found earlier. My office is on a narrow side street, barely one block long. For the most part, the surrounding blocks are posted no parking, which means I have to be inventive in finding ways to squeeze my Mustang into any available space. I was due for a parking ticket, but I hadn't gotten one yet. I drove home along the beach, and within minutes my spirits lifted. Spring in Santa Teresa is marked by early morning sunshine, which is eradicated almost immediately by dense cloud cover. The marine layer, known as the June gloom, usually stretches from late May until early August, but that's been changing of late. Here we'd scarcely made it into April, and low clouds had already erased the offshore islands. Seabirds wheeled through the fog while sailboats tacking out of the harbor disappeared in the mist. In the absence of sunlight, the surf was the color of burnished pewter. Long strands of kelp had washed up on shore. I inhaled the salty essence of damp sand and seagrass. Cars rumbled along the wooden wharf with a sound like distant thunder. It was not quite tourist season, so traffic was light, and many of the beach hotels still sported vacancy signs. I turned left from Cabana onto Bay, and left again onto Albanil. I found a length of empty curb across from my apartment, and paralleled my way into it. I shut the engine down, locked my car, and crossed the street, passing through the squeaking gate that serves the dual purpose of doorbell and burglar alarm. Henry Pitts, my landlord, was in the backyard, in a t-shirt, shorts, and bare feet. He'd set up a ladder near the house, and he was hosing out the rain gutters where a thick, nasty mat of wet leaves had collected over the winter. During the last big rain, small gushers had poured down on the porch outside the kitchen door, drenching anyone who dared to enter or leave. I crossed the patio and stood there for a while, watching him work. The day was getting chilly, and I marveled at his determination to cavort about in so few clothes. "Aren't you going to catch your death of cold?" Henry had turned 88 on Valentine's Day, and while he's sturdy as a fence post, the fact remains he's getting on in years. "Nope, cold preserves most things, so why not me?" "I suppose." The spray from the hose was creating an area of artificial rain, so I stepped back out of range. He turned his hose in the opposite direction, inadvertently watering his neighbor's shrubs.
"You're home early," he remarked.
I gave myself the afternoon off, or what's left of it.
"Hard day?"
I wagged my hand, indicating so-so. I had a guy walk in and hire me for a day's work. As soon as I said yes, I knew it was dumb.
"Tough job?"
More pointless than tough. He gave me $500 in cash, and what can I say? I was seduced.
"What's the assignment?"
"It's complicated."
"Oh, good.
I like it when you're challenged. I'm just about done with this. Why don't you stop by for a glass of wine and you can bring me up to speed?"
"I'd like that.
There's another issue up for grabs, and we can talk about that, too.
Maybe you should stay for supper so we won't feel rushed.
I made cornbread and a pot of beef stew. If you come at 5:30, I'll have time enough to shower and change clothes."
"Perfect. See you shortly."
Henry is the only person alive I'd talk to about a client, with the possible addition of his sister, Nell, who'd be turning 99 in December. His brothers, Charlie, Lewis, and William, were 96, 91, and 90, respectively, and all were going strong. Any talk about the frailties of the elderly has no bearing on them. I let myself into the studio and dropped my shoulder bag on a kitchen stool. I moved to the sitting area, turning on a couple of lamps to brighten the room. I went up the spiral staircase to the sleeping loft, where I perched on the edge of the platform bed and pulled off my boots. Most days, my work attire is casual. Jeans, a turtleneck, and boots or tennis shoes. I can add a tweed blazer if I feel the need to dress up. Though I'm capable of skirts and pantyhose, they're not my first choice. I do own one dress that I'm happy to say is suitable for most occasions. It's black, made of a fabric so wrinkle-resistant if I rolled it up and stored it in my shoulder bag, you'd never know the difference. At the end of the day, my clothes hurt, and I'm eager to be shed of the restraints. I stripped off my jeans and hung them on a peg. I pulled off my shirt and tossed it over the rail. Once I was downstairs again, I'd retrieve it and add it to the garments waiting in the washing machine. In the meantime, I found a set of clean sweats and my slippers, rejoicing, as I always do, that Henry and I are beyond the need to impress each other. As far as I'm concerned, he's perfect, and I suspect he'd say much the same thing about me. I've been his tenant for the past 8 years. At one time, my studio was Henry's single-car garage. He decided he needed a larger one to accommodate his station wagon and his pristine 1932 five-window coupe. So he converted the original garage to a rental unit, which I'd moved into. An unfortunate explosion had flattened my apartment 6 years before, so Henry had redesigned the floor plan, adding a half-story above the kitchen. On the ground floor, I have a living room with a desk and a sofa bed that can accommodate overnight guests. The kitchen is small, a galley-style bump-out off the living room. There's also a bathroom and a combination washer-dryer tucked under the spiral stairs. The whole of it resembles the interior of a small boat, lots of highly polished teak and oak, with a porthole in the front door and nautical blue captain's chairs. The new loft, in addition to a double bed, boasts built-in cubbyholes, as well as a second bathroom, with a view that includes a small slice of the Pacific Ocean visible through the trees. Henry had installed a plexiglass skylight above my bed, so I waked to whatever weather's drifted in during the night. Between the studio and Henry's house, there's a glassed-in passageway where he proofs batches of bread using a shaker cradle, like an enormous buttered bowl. In his working days, he made his living as a commercial baker, and he still can't resist the satiny feel of newly kneaded dough. At 5:29, I grabbed my shoulder bag, crossed the flagstone patio, and tapped on the glass pane in Henry's back door. Most of the time, he leaves it unlocked, but our unspoken agreement is to respect each other's privacy. Unless my apartment was in flames, he'd never dream of entering without permission. I peered through the glass and saw Henry standing at the sink, filling it with hot water into which he was squeezing a long shot of liquid detergent. He took 3 steps back to the side to open the door and then returned to his task. I could see numerous place settings of tarnished silverware on the counter, with a roll of aluminum foil and a clean towel laid out. He'd set an 8-quart pan on the stove, and the water had just reached a rolling boil. On the bottom of the pan, there was a crumpled section of foil. I watched him add a 1/4 cup of baking soda, after which he placed the silverware in the bubbling water with the foil. "Oh, yum! A pot of flatware soup." He smiled. "When I pulled the silver from the canteen, most of it was tarnished. Watch this." I peered into the boiling water and watched as the foil turned dark, and the tarnish disappeared from all the forks, knives, and spoons. "That doesn't do any harm?" "Some people think so, but any time you polish silver, you're removing a thin layer of oxidation. That's a toll pattern, by the way, cascade. I inherited the service for 18 from a maiden aunt who died in 1933. The pattern's discontinued, but if I haunt garage sales, I can sometimes find a piece." "What's the occasion?" "Silver's meant to be used. I don't know why I hadn't thought of it before. It lends a meal an air of elegance, even when we're eating in here." He poked the silverware with a set of tongs, making sure all the pieces were totally submerged. "I put an open bottle of Chardonnay in the refrigerator for you." "Thanks. Will you be having some with dinner?" "As soon as I finish this." He paused to take a swallow of the blackjack over ice that constitutes his usual late afternoon pick-me-up. I retrieved the Chardonnay, took 2 wine glasses from the cupboard, and filled mine halfway. Henry, meantime, was using the tongs to move the silver from the kettle to the sink of soapy water. After a quick rinse, he laid the freshly polished silver on the waiting towel. I took a 2nd towel from the linen drawer and dried the pieces. I set places for 2 at the kitchen table where Henry had laid out freshly ironed cloth napkins and mats. We postponed our conversation about the job until we'd each eaten 2 servings of beef stew. Henry crumbled cornbread in his, but I preferred mine on the side with butter and homemade strawberry jam. Am I in love with this man or what? When we finished our meal, Henry put the dishes and silverware in the sink and returned to the table. Once he was settled, I gave him the Reader's Digest condensed version of the story Michael Sutton had related to me. I said, "Where have I heard the name Michael Sutton? Does it mean anything to you?" "Not offhand." "You know what his father does for a living?" "Not much. He's deceased. Sutton told me both his parents were gone. He's got 2 brothers and a sister, but they're not on speaking terms. He didn't explain himself, and I didn't ask. I wonder if his father was the Sutton who served on the city council. This was maybe 10 years ago. "That I don't know. I suspect the reference will come to me, if there is one." "In the meantime, you have a game plan?" "I've got some ideas percolating at the back of my brain. I want to see what the papers have to say about the Fitzhugh girl. Sutton might have forgotten something relevant or embellished where he should have left well enough alone." "You don't trust him?" "It's not that. I'm worried he's conflating 2 separate events. I believe he saw 2 fellows digging a hole. What I question is the connection to Mary Claire's disappearance. He says the dates line up, but that doesn't count for much." "I guess time will tell. So, what's the other one?" "The other what?" "You said there was another issue up for grabs." "Oh, that." I leaned toward the empty chair where I'd placed my shoulder bag. I retrieved the still-sealed envelope and passed it across the table. "I don't have the nerve to open it. I thought you could peek and tell me what it is." He put on his reading glasses and studied the front and back of the envelope in the same way I had. He slid a finger under the flap and lifted it, then removed a card with an overleaf of tissue. Inside, there was a smaller card with a matching envelope, so the recipient could RSVP. "Says the parsonage, groundbreaking and dedication ceremony, celebrating the removal of the Kinsey family homestead to its new location at blah blah blah. May 28th, 1988. I believe that's the Saturday of Memorial Day weekend. 4 p.m. cocktails and dinner to follow at the country club. Very nice. He turned the invitation so it faced me and I could read it for myself. Big family do, he said. Doesn't say black tie optional, so that's good news. He picked up the smaller card with its stamped envelope. They'd appreciate a reply by May 1st. Couldn't be easier. The envelope's already stamped, so that will save you return postage. Well, now, what do you think of that? This is just not going to go away, is it? I said. Why do they keep harassing me? It's like being nibbled to death by ducklings. He pulled his reading glasses down low on his nose and looked at me over the rims. 2 contacts a year isn't harassment. This is an invitation to a party. It's not like someone put dog turds on the front seat of your car. I barely know these people. And you won't if you keep avoiding them. Reluctantly, I said, I've dealt with Tasha, and she's not so bad. And I'm fond of Aunt Susanna. She's the one who gave me the photograph of my mother and then sent me the family album. I'll admit, I was touched by that. So here's what worries me. Am I just being stubborn for the sake of it? What do they call that? Cutting off your nose to spite your face? I mean, most families want to be close. I don't. Does that make me wrong? Not at all. You're independent. You prefer being alone. True. And I'm pretty sure that's considered the opposite of mental health. Why don't you sleep on it and see how it looks in the morning? Chapter 3. Deborah Unruh, April 1963. Deborah Unruh hated the girl on sight. Her son Greg had dropped out of Berkeley in his sophomore year, claiming his academic courses were irrelevant. Since then, he'd hitchhiked across the country, calling home when his funds were low, and he needed money wired to the nearest Western Union office. Deborah and Patrick had last seen him the previous fall, and now, without warning, he'd reappeared driving a big yellow school bus with a girl named Shelley in tow. She had a gaunt face, a mass of dark, tangled hair, large hazel eyes, and barely visible brows. She wore heavy eye makeup, a black turtleneck sweater, and a long gypsy skirt, the hem of which was torn and gray from trailing on the ground. When she wasn't barefoot, she wore black tights and ragged tennis shoes. She had a little boy with her, Sean, who was 6 years old. She was quick to tell Deborah the child wasn't Greg's. When Deborah made the mistake of asking about her ex-husband, Shelley told her she'd never been married and had no idea who the boy's father was. Her tone implied that only the uptight middle-class bores would be concerned with an outdated concept like paternity. Deborah let the matter pass without comment. But the girl's brazen attitude netted her a black mark in Deborah's eyes. Greg took their welcome for granted, offering no explanation why they'd come or how long they meant to stay. Deborah offered them the guest room, but he and Shelley declined. They preferred to sleep in the bus, which they parked out behind the garage. The vehicle was little more than a shell. They'd removed all the seats and outfitted the interior with beds, a low table and chairs, and a camp stove, though Shelley never lifted a hand when it came to meals. They used a milk crate to hold canned and dried goods, and had cardboard boxes for everything else. Sean slept on a tatty futon behind the driver's seat, while Greg and Shelley occupied a double bed mattress at the rear. An Indian print bedspread was hung between the two beds for privacy. The bus was left close enough to the pool house that the three could use the toilet and shower out there. Not that any of them ever bathed, as far as Deborah could tell. They hadn't been in the house 5 minutes before the little boy had peeled off his clothes and was running around naked. Deborah knew better than to raise an objection, because Shelley was already warbling on about how our bodies were so precious and nothing to be ashamed of. Deborah was appalled. Greg had gone off to college, clean-cut and polite, And here he was back again, promoting this trashy little upstart whose values were equivalent to a slap in the face. At the first opportunity, Deborah excused herself, went up to the master bedroom, and called Patrick in Los Angeles. He was a sportswear manufacturer, and he spent Tuesday morning through Friday afternoon at his plant in Downey. She didn't dare let him come home for the weekend without telling him what was going on. He listened to her description of Shelley, patient and bemused. He made sympathetic noises, but she could tell he thought she was exaggerating. "Don't say I didn't warn you," she sang. Patrick's reaction to Shelley was just as swift as hers. He was more analytical than Deborah, less intuitive, but just as quick to recoil. At 48, he had wiry hair, layered gray and white, cut short, wavy over his ears where the hair was slightly longer. His eyes were brown, his eyebrows a washed-out gray. He was colorblind, so Deborah selected his clothes. His everyday attire was chinos and sport coats that she kept in a range of pale browns and grays. His shirts were a crisp white, open at the collar since he refused to wear ties except on the most formal occasions. He was slim and kept fit doing 5-mile runs when he was home on weekends. Deborah was 4 years younger, a honey blonde wash concealing the natural gray. Like Patrick, she was brown-eyed and slender. The two made a handsome pair, like an advertisement for graceful aging. They played golf together on weekends and the occasional tennis doubles match at the country club. Patrick tolerated the bus people, as he referred to them, for 3 days, and he was on the verge of telling them they'd have to move on when Greg announced that Shelley was 5 months pregnant, expecting in early August, and they needed a place to stay. For one fleeting moment, Deborah wondered if he was telling the truth. Shelley was petite, so slight and bony it was hard to picture her giving birth to a full-term infant. Deborah studied her discreetly. She looked thick through the middle, but that was the sole indication that she was with child. Neither of them seemed embarrassed at her condition, and there was no talk of getting married. Shelley used the occasion to air her views about childbirth. She didn't believe in doctors or hospitals. Childbirth was a natural process and didn't require the services of Western medicine, which was dominated by rich white men whose only goal was to undermine a woman's trust in her body and the freedom to control what happened to it. That night, Patrick and Deborah had the first quarrel they'd had in years. Deborah said, "We can't ask them to leave. You heard Greg. They don't have any place else to stay." "I don't give a shit. He got himself into this and he can get himself out. What the hell's the matter with him? The girl's an idiot and I won't put up with her, pregnant or not. Is he out of his mind?" Deborah gestured to him to keep his voice down, even though Greg, Shelley, and the boy had retired to the bus. "You know, if we kick her out, he'll go too." "Good. The sooner the better. She'll have the baby in a cornfield. If it's what she wants, let her do it. She's in for a rude awakening. Wait till she goes into labor, and then let's hear about the joys of natural childbirth." "She's already had one child. I don't see how the process could come as any big surprise." Deborah let Patrick rant and rave until he ran out of steam, and then she prevailed. She was just as repelled as he was, but this would be their first and perhaps their only grandchild. What good would it do to voice their outrage and disappointment when it wouldn't change a thing? 2 weeks passed before Deborah found a moment alone with her son. She'd been working in the kitchen, putting together an eggplant parmesan that would probably go untouched. Shelley was a vegetarian. Deborah had originally offered to make a tuna casserole, remembering how much Greg liked them as a child. Sean licked his lips, rubbed his tummy, and said, "Yum!" Shelley put a reproving hand on his shoulder and said, "No, thank you. We don't believe any living creature should have to die so we can eat." As soon as they left the kitchen, Deborah repeated the sentiment aloud, mimicking her tone. "Pious twit." Fortunately, they'd planted Japanese eggplant in the vegetable garden. Deborah had gone out and picked half a dozen, which she sliced, salted, and allowed to drain. With Patrick gone the better part of the week, Deborah was accustomed to cooking for herself, and she'd had to rack her brain coming up with meatless meals in deference to Shelley's moral stance. Deborah sprinkled cheese on top of the casserole and placed it in the refrigerator until it was time to bake it. Washing her hands, she peered out the kitchen window and spotted Greg and Sean in the backyard. She knocked on the glass, waving to them, and the next thing she knew, the back door opened and in they came. Greg said, "We're in exile for the afternoon. Shelley's tired and needs a nap." "I'm happy to have the company have a seat," she said. Greg was clueless when it came to entertaining Sean. On the occasions when he was left in charge of the boy, he usually brought him into the house and left it up to his mother to provide him with paper and colored pencils, or the tinker toys she'd had stored in the attic since Greg was his age. Deborah had wanted to talk to him, and now that she had the chance, she wasn't sure how to go about it. She hardly knew what to make of him these days. He was tall, slim, and fair-haired, a younger version of his dad. He'd been a good-hearted kid with an easy disposition. He'd made A's all through school, though the good grades hadn't come easily for him. Because he struggled so hard, she thought his achievements had been meaningful to him. Perhaps he'd only excelled out of a desire to please his parents. Until he left for college, there was no sign of rebellion or defiance. He wasn't oppositional, and there was nothing in his behavior to suggest he was disenchanted with the life his parents had provided. Shelley was a revelation. Clearly, this girl embodied attitudes he'd been harboring for years without the means or perhaps the courage to express them. Bringing her home, he was sending a message. "This is what I want and what I admire." Deborah could only hope he'd realize how far off track he was. She'd tried to be accepting of Shelley, for his sake, if nothing else, but everything about the girl was repugnant. Of course, Shelley didn't approve of Deborah any more than Deborah approved of her. She was smart enough to avoid Patrick altogether, sensing he was an adversary she'd regret taking on. She disdained their lifestyle and made little effort to disguise her animosity. For Deborah, tact and good manners were the ballast that kept social interactions on an even keel. For Shelley, being blunt and abrasive was proof she was being authentic. Without the buffer of mutual courtesy, Deborah was at a loss. And though she hated to admit it, she was afraid of the girl. Greg went into the refrigerator and found a container of leftover spaghetti with meatballs that he proceeded to eat cold. Eyeing him, Sean said, "I'm hungry." "What about Velveeta?" Deborah said with a quick look at Greg. He was responsible for enforcing Shelley's food laws when she wasn't in the room. Deborah had given up trying to make sense of Shelley's rules, which were arbitrary, capricious, and non-negotiable. Greg shrugged his approval, so Deborah opened the package of Velveeta and handed Sean a slice. He wandered into the living room, engrossed in peeling off pieces and dropping them in his mouth like a baby bird. He wasn't allowed to watch television, and Deborah hoped he'd find a way to amuse himself without getting into trouble. She filled the sink with soapy water, tucking in the dirty bowls and utensils before she took a seat at the table. She knew Greg didn't want to have a heart-to-heart talk, but she had him cornered, and he seemed resigned. "I've been thinking about Shelley, and I realized I didn't know anything about her family." "Where's she from?"
"Los Angeles. Tustin or Irvine, I forget which," he said. "Her family disowned her when she was 15 and got pregnant with Sean."
"That's too bad. It must be hard for her."
"Nah. They didn't get along anyway, so it was no big deal. She says they're a bunch of pigs with their heads up their butts."
"I see." She hesitated and then plunged on. "I'm not sure this is the time to bring it up, but your father and I are curious about your plans. I wondered if you wanted to discuss the situation."
"Not particularly."
"Plans for what?"
"We assumed you'd be looking for a job."
She heard Sean giggling, and she looked over to see him round the corner from the living room, stark naked. He dashed into the kitchen with a certain brash confidence, whooping and leaping to claim their attention. Deborah looked over at him coolly as he shook his bottom at them and galloped away. She could hear his bare feet slapping down the hall as he ran around the house, circling through the living room, dining room, kitchen, the front hall, and back through the living room. Clearly, Greg had learned to block out the child's shrieking, which Shelley, of course, encouraged as freedom of expression. A job? Doing what? You have a family to support. At the bare minimum, you have to have income and a decent place to live. What's wrong with the bus? We're doing fine, unless you begrudge us the parking space. Of course we don't begrudge you the parking space. Don't be ridiculous. All I'm saying is that once the baby's here, you can't go on living like vagabonds. Shelley doesn't want to be tied down. She likes being on the road. Lots of our friends do the same thing, and it's groovy. You gotta go with the flow. What will you do for money? Babies are expensive. Surely I don't have to tell you that. Mom, would you cool it with this stuff? I'm 21 years old. I don't need your advice. We'll take care of it, okay? Deborah let that one roll off her back and tried again. Could you at least give us an idea how long you plan to stay? Why? You want us out of here? Sean tiptoed into the room like a cartoon character with exaggerated steps. Deborah watched him creep up on Greg with his hands out in front of him like claws. He let out a fake roar and gave Greg a swipe. Greg growled and grabbed at him. Sean screamed with laughter as he galloped toward the dining room.
You can't catch me! You can't catch me! Na, na, na!
He stopped and made a face, fingers wiggling at his ears. Off he went again. Deborah absolutely could not stand the child. She said,
Why are you being so argumentative? That's not like you. I'm trying to get a sense of your intentions, if it's not too much to ask.
Who says I have to have intentions? Fine. You have no plans and no intentions. We do. We're willing to have you stay here until the baby's born, but it can't be permanent.
Would you get off that stuff? I said we'd take care of it, and we'll take care of it.
Deborah stared at him, struck by his refusal to address reality. This was the first time she'd understood how immature he was. He had no idea what he'd gotten himself into. He'd adopted Shelley's worldview, but without foundation or depth. Maybe it was the same form of parroting that had gotten him through school. I don't understand what you see in her.
Shelley's cool.
She's a free spirit. She isn't all hung up on material things. The way we are. Is that what you mean?
Mom, you don't have to be so defensive. I didn't say that. Did I say that?
You've been looking down your noses at us since the day you walked in. Shelley despises us.
That's not true.
Of course it is. Why don't you just admit it?
You despise her, so why don't you admit that?
Take a look at yourselves. Dad works to make money so you can buy, buy, buy. His employees scrape out a living at minimum wage, and he reaps the profits. Are you proud of it?
Yes, I am. And why not? He's worked hard to get where he is. He provides jobs and benefits for hundreds of people who are devoted to him. Most of them have been with him for over 15 years, so they must not feel too downtrodden.
Shit. Have you ever really talked to those guys? Do you have any idea what their lives are like? You pat yourselves on the back for doing good deeds, but what does that amount to? You and your hoity-toity girlfriends have charity luncheons, raising a pittance for whatever tidy little cause has taken your fancy. What difference does it make in the overall scheme of things? None of you put yourselves on the line. You're safe and you're smug, and you wouldn't dream of dirtying your hands with the real problems out there.
I wouldn't be so quick to judge if I were you. You talk about safe and smug. You've had everything handed to you. You blew off your education, and now you're playing house, thinking you're a grown-up when you haven't accepted a shred of responsibility for yourself or Shelley or even that poor son of hers. What have you done that makes you think you're superior?
I'll tell you what we've done. We're civil rights activists. You didn't know that, did you? Because you never bothered to ask about our beliefs. We've marched in support of freedom rides desegregating bus terminals and restrooms and water fountains in the South. Deborah was taken aback.
You went to Washington, D.C.?
Well, no. There was a rally in San Francisco. There were hundreds of us. You and Dad are sheep. You'd go along with anything just to avoid making waves. You've never stood up for anything.
She could feel a flash of temper. Watch your